You are now tuned in to Preach Like a Girl, the podcast with Reverend Dr. Kimberly Majeski. This is where women's voices in ministry take center stage. Join us as we inspire, challenge, and uplift through real conversations, biblical insights, and stories that empower. Because preaching isn't just for the pulpit, it's for every woman called to speak truth. This is Preach Like a Girl. Let's get into it.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Preach Like a Girl podcast. We are so excited today to have Dr. Lynn Kohick with us, who is the Distinguished Professor of New Testament and the Director of Houston Theological Seminary Education. Welcome, Lynn Kohick. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you so much, Kimberly, for inviting me on to Preach Like a Girl. I love it. I've been on before, right? But time has passed, so it's good. It's good to reconnect.
That's right. Time has passed. You've done new stuff. We've been together on some stuff. So Lynn is a colleague and a friend, one of my favorite scholars in the space of early church history and New Testament biblical exegesis and work. And so it's always fun to talk to you. Lynn, tell us what's going on. I know you have some exciting things happening, sort of a new or newish venture that you've been working on having to do with women in Christian history. And so but tell our listeners a little bit about that.
Yes. Well, and you're a partner in crime in that too, Kimberly. So we have a 501c3 called the Center for Women in Leadership. And that umbrella, under that umbrella, is my podcast, Alabaster Jar. But also under that umbrella is something we call the Visual Museum of Women in Christianity. And it is kind of a multifaceted endeavor. We have a website that features women in the early church or artwork that depicts biblical women from catacombs, which is your favorite, all the way on up. And we go through basically the medieval period, I would say, less so in information. So a lot of, you know, our history, maybe we're up to 1400, something like that, with Catherine of Siena, Claire of Assisi. Some of your listeners would be familiar with that, with those names. So very important figures in the life of the church. And we try to feature artwork that tells their story so that not only, I mean, a lot of people, so many women have said to me, why didn't I know about her? You know, why didn't I know? And sometimes it can make them a little angry. Like, why did the church, I've been going to church all my life. How come I never heard of the martyrs Perpetua and Felicitas, who made such, such an impact that Augustine, on the anniversary of their martyrdom, would give sermons, you know, and everybody knows Augustine, but, you know, they don't know these faithful women who, in the case, in their case, Perpetua kept a diary. So not only are they memorialized in mosaics in Ravenna, let's say, Italy, beautiful mosaics there, but her diary was preserved. Mm-hmm. And not expanded on, but preserved and then put in this story. So the last chapter, obviously, she didn't write. It was when she was in the arena and gave her life for her faith. But then annually, the church remembers her. Yeah. So this visual museum is trying to tell that story, but also show that story. And you know how important that is in your work in the catacombs. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So one of the things that I think I've learned from you and others in our field is really the import of art and imagery We have, you know, women named in the biblical text, and then they sort of in the record drop off of history. Yes. And one of the contributions, I think, of your work has really been to point us to those visual representations that then begin to tell the stories and fill in the gaps of those narratives that we might not be able to find in manuscripts, or it helps us pair back to manuscript evidence.
That's right. Yeah. For the first time this year, I went to the Priscilla Catacombs.
How did you find it? Did you love it?
Loved it. So that's another thing that the Center for Women in Leadership does, is it sponsors trips. We've done our second trip now to Italy. We did it over the Christmas holiday. And in Italy, they really take seriously the 12 days of Christmas. So Christmas kind of starts on the 25th, and then there's celebration till Epiphany Sunday, or the 6th of January. So one of the things that we were able to do was to go through the Priscilla Catacombs. We had the most delightful guide, Sister Rita. Oh, she's a faithful believer and, you know, so knowledgeable, and just seeing the art. Well, I mean, it's amazing to me. It's like you step back, and you know as well, you step back into time and you realize my sisters in Christ worshiped here.
Yeah.
More than 1,000 years ago. And it's like you enter into a space of community with that great cloud of witness that has gone before. So it was incredibly moving. Another experience that was quite moving to many of the students and also to me is we went to the church of there's Praxedes and Prudenciana. There's two sisters, and there's churches, yeah, as you know, cathedrals in Rome dedicated to both of them. And these women would go to where martyrs had been executed and gather up the body and wash the body and bury the body. That's a very important ritual or rite. There's nothing superstitious about it. They weren't, you know, worried that the martyr spirit would, roam around the dark streets at night. Rather, they really wanted to honor the martyr's testimony, but they put themselves at great risk, of course, in doing that. And it's a story we don't know about, but their churches are right there. And in one of you can get on the visual museum, you can get to that visualmuseum.gallery. Mm-hmm. And we have a whole page on Prudenciana and Praxedes. And in it, you can see some of the pictures from each of these churches. And in one case, the sisters are portrayed in a mosaic at the front of the church, the apse. And of course, Christ is in the center. And next to him are Peter and Paul. And then beside Peter and Paul are the two sisters. And each of the apostles has one arm around the sister in a friendship, like, I'm bringing this great saint to Christ. And one of the people on the trip were like, well, those apostles are not following the Billy Graham rule. Oh, you got, but it was an emotional time. Sometimes when you're emotional, you come out with a joke, but it is quite moving. And these women were rightly celebrated without apology as central to the life of the church.
Yeah. And I think that the work that we endeavor to do is so important, because it's when you stand there in those spaces and you're connected to the women who went before us and to the way that they helped nurture and I think shape the early church, you're aware there's a story here. There are pieces, you stand in Priscilla's, the queen of the catacombs, and you see those three images with the Velagio woman. And you, if you know her story, there's no way to not see that these are three epics of her testimony, you know, devoid from that. I'm sure you can put all sorts of meanings to it. Go ahead.
Well, yes. And I think that what you said about being like part of the church's life, Praxedes and Prudenciana gave their life. They ended up also being martyred. Yes. And I think today, and what I love about your work, Preach Like a Girl, and just the academic work also that you do, is you hold women to the same high standard that men are held in terms of knowing the Bible, preaching faithfully, living a life of a disciple, come what may. And I get discouraged sometimes today when women, the only things they're kind of given to feed them, if you will, are these fluffy Bible studies that, I think, no. That's, there is no such thing as pink discipleship.
That's right.
You can't help but see that in Rome, in Florence, in Assisi, in Siena. And of course, all other places. You go to Ireland, you know, with St. Bridget. I mean, these women were in the age of the martyrs giving their lives. And then after Constantine made Christianity a legal religion, you had women who still put their life and reputation on the line. I think of Catherine of Siena.
Yeah.
She convinced Pope Gregory the Ninth to come back to Rome. The history of the papacy is an interesting one. Should I just say it that way? Yes. And so at one point, the Pope was living in Avignon, France, and it was very important. Catherine of Siena and others in Italy felt that the Pope should return. So she went and talked with him. And he listened and was convinced and moved back to Rome.
Yeah. You know, I think that's so true. I mean, all through the story, the women are there. They're just, their stories have kind of either not been recorded or recorded in different ways. And it's all just kind of lying there in the dust, ready for us to kind of shake it off and lift it up. I was writing yesterday about, you know, how it is that these women also had homes to run and in many cases, husbands to answer and businesses that they had to attend to, children they had to nurture. And yet they stepped into this calling and lived it without hesitation. Of course, we weren't there. Maybe they did, but they achieved. They held forward in what God had called them to do. And
men listened. I mean, Pope Gregory the Ninth listened. Saint Clare of Assisi, who was very much influenced by Francis of Assisi. A Pope also visited her in her convent or monastery and invited her to pray over the meal, over the bread. And when she finished her prayer, there was a cross that had been made, like indented miraculously in the bread. Mm-hmm. And that really touched me this time. I read that and I thought how good God is that he honored Clare of Assisi in front of the Pope.
Yeah.
By saying, I've heard you. Like, here is proof. I heard you. She also, she was very, both Catherine of Siena and Clare of Assisi really focused on the Eucharist. And at this time in church history, and still among Catholics and Lutherans today, and some Anglicans, they think of the Eucharist as being the actual body and blood of Christ, miraculously changed. And even if you don't go with that, a doctrine called transubstantiation if you're Catholic, or consubstantiation if you're Protestant. But I think a lot of Christians, even if, you know, you're more of the Anabaptist or Pentecostal or whatever tradition, all of us realize this is a very special meal, and it represents what Christ did for us on the cross and is very special to us. But at this time, with Claire of Assisi, Catherine of Siena, it was really a very important part of their discipleship. And they focused on being nourished by Christ. Mm-hmm. And I think we're not going to do it in the same way that they did, but just that sense of a daily nourishment of Christ. Mm-hmm. And at one point, Claire of Assisi, when the town itself was being surrounded by what they called Saracens, these were Muslims, you know, just fighting things, Claire took the a bit of bread that had been consecrated to be, you know, the body of Christ, and she had it in a special container called a ciborium. And, you know, there's this army around her. There's Claire, who had been sick and yet still got off her little mat, walked out to the like walls of her monastery and told them to go home, and held up the host and said, go home. Mm-hmm. And they did. Mm-hmm. And she did that twice. So I think there's tremendous bravery and courage. Mm-hmm. And that comes, I think, from a life of committed prayer and thinking about daily nourishment in Christ, which for a lot of us Protestants functions a little bit more as like reading the word, mm-hmm. which these women also did, but the with literacy and the way the church just kind of functioned back then was much more on Eucharist than it would be like how Protestants today, where we're a highly literate group. And so we can daily feed on Christ in his word.
Yeah. And that was so central. Mm-hmm. To her sustenance, to their sustenance. You read all through the mm-hmm. The contemplatives. That's such an important piece. Well, because you're one of my favorite biblical scholars, we have a couple things that we want to share. Because you're one of my favorite biblical scholars, we've invited you to be you're our kickoff speaker for our event this June. In Denver, called Refresher. We'll link up everything down below, but really inviting women to just come and soak up mm-hmm. The word, the spirit present with other women gathering. And so just want to ask you anything you're looking forward to or anticipating in our time together in Denver this June.
Well, I one of the things I love is to be part of a worship group. And when there are only women voices singing, it just does something.
Yeah.
You know, it just, I think about how beautiful that sounds to the Lord around his throne. So that is something that I really look forward to, is that worship time. I also really look forward to women sharing their stories with me. And that happens serendipitously, right? You know, you're just walking in a hallway, someone comes up and says, oh, you know, I just got to tell you this. And I always come away so encouraged.
Yeah.
Even if it's hard.
Yeah.
It's like, it'll be hard together. And as we do it together, maybe the load will be a little lighter as we share it. But yeah, so those are things that aside from the program, which I always learn things from that and enjoy preparing. I don't know. I haven't really landed. There's a couple of things you and I can talk about. Like, what do you want me to talk about? But, you know, all kinds of.
Right. You know, in terms of preaching, my gosh, I got to preach this weekend. I don't have everything. You know.
I got some ideas. Yep.
Well, our women are going to love you. They've, of course, been exposed to you. I've referenced your work and shared your books with them. They know your scholarship. They have been familiar with your podcast, The Alabaster Jar, which we'll make sure there's link outs to that. But we also have an event coming up even before June. Do you want to share a little bit about Tell Believe Story and what we have coming up in April?
Yes, thank you. So the again, this visual museum, one of the aspects of it is to gather women together for what we've called a symposium. Although one of the fellas that works with us, George Kalantzis, who you can tell is Greek, grew up in Athens, and he said, "You can't use symposium. There's no alcohol here." I said, "Okay, we're not going to back to Plato's time. Okay, it's not that kind of symposium. Come on." But anyway, we chose the word symposium because it's a gathering, right? It's a gathering of people, men and women, who are interested in the stories of women in the life of the church, biblical women, and how they're how teaching about these biblical women extended into the church. And a lot of times, the stories of these biblical women, like Mary Magdalene, for example, gets quite embellished and always not in a good way. But then she's depicted in so many ways. Donatello's sculpture of the penitent Mary is one of the most moving. And also Giotto's, he has in the Church of Assisi, the big cathedral there, a series of the seven main events that tradition has in Mary Magdalene's life. And Giotto is just an amazing, gorgeous artist. Mm-hmm. And so you look at these and you think, is this Mary of Scripture? What did they get right? What have they embellished? How can I learn from it? What do I maybe need to rethink? So in our visual, in our symposium, this will be our third one. It's entitled Believe Her Story. We want to listen to God through women, right? Because God does speak through women. And so we're excited. This is April 3rd and 4th. It's being held at Wheaton College. You will be one of the speakers. So I'm thrilled that you are participating.
Oh, because I want them to be able to come and glean from that. So
yes, good, good. Yes, absolutely. And the keynote speaker this year is Beth Allison Barr. And
Love her, and
she'll be featuring her new book, Pastor's Wife. And so we're very excited about that. And just one of the fun things that's going to happen, as I read through her book, which will be coming out soon, I think next month.
March or April? Is it March?
I think it's March. Yeah. Yeah. Because this is April 3rd and 4th, and it'll have just been released. But as I was reading through it, one of the pre-pub kind of, looking through it, she mentions women across the history. I mean, she's a medievalist by training, right? So she's very familiar with the role of women at that time period. But she talks about catacombs as well. And I started going through just keeping a record of all the women that she mentions. And so the Visual Museum, we will release a special, I don't know if you want to say collection, that cites and shows pictures of art of all the women that Beth mentions in her book. So that's kind of fun, you know. Yeah. You'll be able to believe her story, see her story, tell her story. You know, all those.
And it's very important enough for my gratitude for the Visual Museum, just as a professor, as an educator, to have a source to go to look at, you know, incredible images of these women when we want to talk about them in class and those kind of things. So your website is really a great resource for the church and the academy. And mm-hmm. I've been really, I've used it in my courses.
Oh, that's so great.
So, yeah. All right. Well, I can't wait to see you in April. That'll be fun. We have three quick questions that I like to ask all of our podcast guests, because it just helps us sort of level the playing ground. Here's some things about other folks who are a part of our legacy and story as we became preachers and teachers and leaders in the church. So, first question, who would be a woman preacher or ministry leader who's had a big impact on your life? I'm sure there are plenty. I'm sure there are many. Can you think of one who's had a big impact on you?
As you say that, I think the failure of anyone coming to my mind, I think, speaks volumes. Mm-hmm. When we lived in Denver, we went to a church that whose senior pastor was a woman, and that was wonderful. And she and I would meet for lunch, I don't know, every other month. And that was really special. Mm-hmm. But the women who have influenced me are women in the academy.
Yeah.
Because that's where they could serve.
Yes.
You know, and so I'm not picking from many women in ministry, so to speak, like from my church environment, mm-hmm. but I can think of a lot in the academy. So,
yeah, well,
you know,
Nate, tell us some of those, because I think of that as a ministry too. So, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, now I'm going to leave somebody out, you know, but people that I've worked with, like Sandy Richter, people that I've done life with for over 20 years, Janine Brown, New mm-hmm. Testament, Sandy, Old Testament, people that I've done projects with, like Carolyn Kaminsky. She's up in at Gordon Conwell. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh. And then I just think of all the women. Now, I mean, I will leave people out. You know, this is like the award ceremony. You need to have like this whole list of people, but I'm highlighting, I think, from like my time at Wheaton with, and all the women that I've just mentioned to you are my age. So there's a lot of women who are a little bit younger than me or a lot younger than me, who I also just love being around. But I would say like with Janine, with Karen Jobes, who's retired now from Wheaton, Sandy Richter, Carol Kaminsky, we had a certain experience, in the academy.
Mm-hmm. It occurs to me too, that you were tilling ground, you know, yeah. You know, there weren't this, there wasn't this, a plethora of women biblical scholars doing what you're now doing for those of us coming behind. So it was a different, yes. It was a different moment and a different dynamic for sure. Yeah.
And it's important. I mean, I love your question because it really does highlight, we don't do this alone.
Yeah.
We absolutely need each other, cross generation for sure. And I mean, you just, nobody can do it alone, men or women, but in certain roles, the pressures are such that it's really important to have
yeah.
other women who are kind of going through the same thing and you feel you can have their support.
Yeah. Okay. This next one's a little harder, but it's given to you under the premise that, you know, some listeners could self-eliminate because they would say, well, I can't do what Lynn Cowick is doing, or she's so accomplished, she's done all this. So we like to ask this question because we know what is true. We learn more from our failures, our mistakes, than we do our successes. So can you think of a mistake or failure in ministry, in preaching, that taught you something, that shaped you, and sort of what did it teach you?
Yeah.
I have to advertise mine.
Well, I think you know, as you framed the question, I really love that you said, we eliminate ourselves. We take ourselves out of the race. We are, or can be, our hardest critics. Mm-hmm. So I would, so I love that you're saying, what is a mistake? Because a mistake to me is something you can learn from, as opposed to something that disqualifies you.
Yeah.
And I'll definitely answer this. I'm not trying to stall, but I do also want to acknowledge that in my experience, women are allowed fewer mistakes. If yes. men get three swings at bat, women might get two, maybe only one. And so I think we feel our mistakes more deeply because they are more, they can be judged more harshly.
Right.
And so you know, we might want to take ourselves to task for being quote unquote perfectionists. Part of that is because we know often that's how we're judged. Whereas a fella just isn't as, there is a sense that a man will grow into a job. I mean, these studies show this, right?
Yes.
And we know studies are always right. I think the evidence is pretty clear that men are seen as, if they step into a job, that they can grow into it. So they might have five or six of the qualifications, but they'll get the rest up to the 10 that is necessary. Women tend not to be given that benefit of the doubt. And so I think, anyway, that mistakes, women experience mistakes differently than men, I think, or are seen.
Yeah.
So having said all that, what we need to do, of course, is first and always keep our eyes fixed on Jesus. And so our reactions to when we feel we have done something wrong, when we know we have done something wrong and a mistake, that first and foremost, we go before the Lord, and it's He who will judge us. Mm-hmm. So I can think of a couple of times where in one case, it was a very busy time at work. These examples will all be when I was in administration.
Sure.
We were having both classes going and speakers coming in and all of this. And this was also kind of coming out of COVID. And so how are we managing people online? And they hadn't thought about the fact that we were doing an event only for people in person, but not online. And that was going to be a problem. And so I remember just there at an elevator saying to the guy, well, what do you mean? You know, and there, I mean, it wasn't like I dressed him down or screamed and yelled, but I was frustrated. I don't know that I would say I was angry, but I was frustrated. Like, what? And as soon as I said it, I realized, oh my gosh, that was out of line. And so apologized. And then later went back because it was in a hallway. So other people could have heard, right? Went back again and apologized. Another time I was in a meeting and discussing some sort of policy curriculum. And anytime you do something like that, there's a lot at stake for different stakeholders, right? Around the table. And one person said what they wanted to say. And I didn't realize that there was a backstory to that. And it was being heard by others in a certain way. And so at face value, I thought, okay, not realizing what had happened. Once I was told, hey, wait a minute, this is the full story. I'm like, oh my gosh. And again, then went to a person that was affected by that and said, hey, I now know the full story. I'm sorry. Like, this was not what I intended. This is not what I thought what was going on. And I'm really sorry with that. So nobody really likes to be wrong, but there is, I think, a burden placed on us to apologize, a burden placed on God. And then if the person in these cases, I think both happen to be men, both men, you know, received my apology very graciously, and I'm thankful for that. But I think that, that would be a mistake that then I tried to, once I realized, I need to apologize. And it's, you know, it's no fun to not be up to speed, but we'll always.
And I think in most cases, when we do, I always say I'm a fighter, not a lover. So I have a million stories of when I've said the thing and then have to go back and go, you know what? And I think most people hear us, you know, when we say, okay, that was wrong. Let me do that again. So thanks for sharing that with us.
Yeah.
All right. Final question. A female biblical or early church figure that you most identify or align with?
I think it would be the Samaritan woman, but the Samaritan woman as I understand her. I think she's been grossly misunderstood.
Yes.
So I've not had five husbands, nor am I living with one who's not my husband now. Okay. We've been married 40 some years now. So happily all those years. So that's not what I identify with. What I identify, nor do I think she's an outcast. So nor do I, and I don't think of myself as an outcast. What this chapter four in John is stressing, what we see in this is Jesus having a theological discussion with a woman. And in that, he teaches such amazing theological truth that we have become so accustomed to, we don't realize how revolutionary it is. Those who worship God will worship him in spirit and in truth. Mm-hmm. At this time, both Jews and pagans and Samaritans, they all had sacred spaces, temples, shrines. That's where, and there were still animal sacrifices being done, which kind of necessitated this sacred space and a sacred altar, and, you know, priests, or in the pagan case, also female priests, priestesses, who, you know, did the rituals to affect, you know, whatever change they wanted. And of course, for the in Jerusalem, forgiveness of sins and purity codes and all that. Mm-hmm. So for Jesus to say to her and expect that she would follow along, that there will come a time when all will worship God in spirit and in truth, is incredible. It's the longest dialogue in John. Mm-hmm. And she evangelizes her town and they all convert. Mm-hmm. I would love to have that kind of fruit from whatever ministry God gives me. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. And so I think because I love theology, I love study, and I see Jesus being totally fine with that, mm-hmm. in the fact that he talks with the Samaritan woman about that. Yep.
I love that, that communion in that theological discourse, and that would be something that you identify with. Seems like it fits to me.
Good.
Dr. Lynn Coick, thank you so much for being our guest today. I'm so looking forward to being with you April 3rd and 4th in Chicago at Wheaton. And then you'll be our guest in June at our refresher event in Denver. So can't wait to see you in both places. And we want our listeners to know we'll be leading a trip. We have 12 spots open for our study of early church women in Greece and Turkey, leaving this August 31st, 2025. So we'll put information about that. We want you to travel with us and experience those stories up close and personal. All right. Well, thank you so much, my friend.
Thank you, appreciate your time today.
I know our listeners have enjoyed hearing from you, and I look forward to seeing you soon.
Same here. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
That's a wrap on this episode of Preach Like a Girl. We hope you're feeling inspired, empowered, and ready to walk boldly in your calling. If you loved today's conversation, be sure to subscribe and share it with someone who needs to hear it. Keep preaching, keep leading, and keep showing up because your voice matters. Until next time, this is Preach Like a Girl.